From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, September 19th, 2024. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, Gavchish, Hawa, Tuxuk Newsom, Salamat, for joining the conversation. On today's show, we talk with filmmakers behind Refuge Alaska, a new musical and cinematic project highlighting 13 of Alaska's refuges. It's all to help celebrate National Public Land Day on September 27th. We preview a talk tomorrow night with two world-renowned polar explorers who are crossing 20 of the world's largest ice fields, including the one here in Juneau. It's about adventure, exploration, and awareness. Nami Juno is here to share about their family and friends class that informs and supports those who have loved ones with a mental health condition. Those conversations and more coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Hanson Gress, Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta kanakaya ha ani kak, gunish cheese.
You're listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That's KT Tunstall with Century Trail when she was in the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. 13 of Alaska's 16 wildlife refuges will be featured in a new music and cinematic experience called Refuge Alaska. It's created in part to help celebrate National Public Land Day happening next week. The project is headed by Sustain Music and Nature, a nonprofit organization based in the United States that aims to bridge the gap between the music industry and environmental conversation. And joining me now to talk about this wonderful project is Betsy Mortensen, the co-founder of Sustain Music and Nature, and Sam Kassir, creative director and producer of Refuge Alaska. Gunath Chisha Ye Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you join us. Wasa Iati, how's it going?
Thanks so much for having us. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Sam. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Great. And it's great because that music I was playing was from another project that you had done here in Alaska. That Century Trail by KT Tunstall. And the video is available on the website, which is sustainmusicandnature.org. And you can find out, of course, all about everything that your nonprofit does on that website, which is really cool. But I wanted to start with you, Betsy, and ask, tell us a little bit about what is Sustain Music and Nature.
Yeah, so Sustain Music and Nature is an organization that uses music to engage new fans for our public lands. So by kind of tapping into the emotional sway that musicians have and the cultural capital of our especially more well-known musicians, we're able to reach audiences that might otherwise not care about public lands or just not ever have any reason to interact with them or pay attention. So music is sort of our entryway into bringing our national parks, wildlife refuges, and forests to a wider audience.
I love that. And I know that music is so powerful and affects us emotionally to our core, right? And in terms of how it can move us and empower us to action, which is kind of cool. So how did the concept of bridging music and nature form for you as the co-founder for Sustained?
Yeah, so my background's in conservation and wildlife biology. And my co-founder and also husband, Harrison Goodell, he is from the music industry. So he was part of a touring band called Parsons Field. And almost 10 years ago now, we're sort of thinking about ways that we could combine our two passions and knowing how much power music has and how much the environmental movement has kind of struggled to take a joyful approach to environmentalism. We're like, all right, here we go. We got music. We got my connections to public lands and conservation. Let's try it out. Let's take a new approach.
I love that. So it's a husband and wife conversation that sort of began. Was it something that happened over time, or was it who was the instigator? Who said, hey, you know what? We could combine forces. Or was it sort of a natural progression of conversation over like dinner or whatever?
Yeah. So at the time in 2015, I was working for Teddy Roosevelt's great, great grandson, Simon Roosevelt, who, I don't know, it runs in the blood or something, but he's also a very passionate public lands advocate. And I was inspired by the work he was doing. I was living in New York City, which is not my favorite place as a child of the woods. And Harrison and I just got talking in a coffee shop in Toronto one day while he was on tour. And we're like, you know what? This has potential. Let's have some brainstorm sessions.
It's great when an idea can just come out over a cup of coffee, right? That's kind of cool. For you and your background, like you said, you were a child of the woods. Is that where sort of the inherent passion for public lands for you comes from? And how did you get interested in pursuing that as a career even before you started Sustain?
Yeah. So growing up in Connecticut, I know someone's first impression of Connecticut is probably like Greenwich and like, oh, you're just the suburbs of New York City and Boston. But there are some really, not Alaska rural level, but there are rural areas. There's some beautiful state forests. I grew up learning how to hunt and fish from my dad, and I pursued a wildlife biology degree at Colorado State. And just the beauty of all the parks and protected areas that gave me so much joy. I just really wanted to make sure that those places still exist for future generations.
I see. I love that. That is really cool. Okay, so let's talk a little bit to you, Sam, as the creative producer for Refuge Alaska, and you're also the creative director for Sustain, it sounds like. But how did this idea come about for Refuge Alaska?
So this particular idea, I had actually just joined the organization because I have a huge love for these public lands. And I thought that the marriage they were doing with that and musicians was a really great idea and something I could actually, you know, I thought I could actually help with. And so, but a lot of their projects, just like the KT Tunstall, you may have heard a little bit of at the onset of the program, are sort of in-person projects. So I joined right before COVID, and then immediately no one could see anybody in person. And around that time, I think Betsy got access to all this amazingly gorgeous footage from these refuges in Alaska. And I thought, well, maybe we could remotely team up with some friend composers and help write music to this. To just help raise awareness about the awe-inspiring nature and importance and beauty of these public lands. And so we put together an edit. It's an 11-minute piece project with four of us as composers. We're all musicians and also members of other bands. And we have sort of what we call chapters of these four different parts of the film. And so we did it sequentially, and each chapter has a theme. Mine, for instance, was aerials. There's a underwater theme. There's a flora fauna theme. There's a birds one. And so, that's how it came about and how we sort of started working on it.
Wow, that sounds so good. So, Betsy, how did you come about the footage? I know that in Alaska, obviously, I mean, Alaska is a huge place. And as I mentioned at the top, we have 16 wildlife refuges here in Alaska. And they are so important because they protect and provide crucial, you know, habitats for vulnerable species and many other things that are part of that. And they range from like the coastal areas to the tundra and the mountains. And so we have all different, you know, aspects of wildlife here. And so I'm interested in knowing, where did that footage come from? How did you acquire that?
Yeah, so we had worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on some of our traditional songscape projects in the lower 48 at Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge, Seedskiddy National Wildlife Refuge, and a few others. And through those connections, I guess word spread that Sustain is cool. And we connected with the Alaska region of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they were keen to highlight your refuges, and so were we. And kind of got to brainstorming and learning about the resources they had with all their really top-notch footage of the refuges.
I see. Okay. Have either of you ever had the pleasure of coming to Alaska?
We actually had a premiere at the Anchorage Museum. Fantastic art museum where we showed the film and then also at a concert. And then the film was on display for about a month, I think, if that's right, Betsy. So me and Betsy here and Harrison went for that premiere, and we also took a road trip to Homer. We didn't make it to Juneau, but it's next on my list of hopefully many visits. But it was really amazing. I mean, for me, it was amazing because I had never been, and I'd been watching this footage for months putting this film together. And so it was really a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, a lot of times people go up north, south central, or even further up north, and, you know, Juneau and southeast, a little more remote. You have to fly or take a boat to many places to get to some of the communities down here. And but it is beautiful. It is beautiful all around, all across the state of Alaska, but hopefully you can make it. I know you're both calling in from the East Coast. So tell me a little bit more, Sam, about the music in this film. You described it a little bit. There's some different parts to it, almost like movements to like an orchestral piece or a concert piece. But who are the musicians that are involved in this? You sound like you're one of them. Who else is involved, and what kind of music will we be experiencing throughout the film?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, and to just to go back to why this sort of combination is so important, you know, music, at its purest, is a reflection of life, right? And so I feel like music tells everything that words can't tell. Not to get too broad real quick, but like, I feel like that's why music can be a good vehicle for really mirroring the importance and all the emotions that you experience when you go to these places, which in this case is incredibly remote, so not everyone can go. But yeah, so the four composers are me, a gentleman named Aki Burmis, who's in a band called Lake Street Dive, Matt Douglas, who's in a band called The Mountain Goats, and Derry DeBorgia, who's in a band with Jason Isbell, who's also played in Alaska a bunch. I think actually all of those bands have played in Alaska a good amount. I'm a music producer myself. I also do some touring with a fellow named Josh Ritter, and that's who we played with at the museum. And so along with someone we knew that had the footage, we sort of went back and forth a lot about the idea, about how long it should be and how it should be formatted. And we came to this idea of four different sort of thematic chapters. And we just sort of let each composer interpret those chapters as they wanted. So one of them is all voices. One of them is all woodwind instruments. Mine is predominantly treated synthesizers and reverse pianos and stuff. And then there's another that's sort of keyboard centric. But it's really fun to see how people mirror these and interpret this footage from these scenes.
Yeah. So for you as a composer, that's an interesting thing. So you had your section of the film, and what was your process like in creating it? Was it just sort of watch it again and again and again and get inspired? Or did you, what did you see in the footage that inspired the music?
Yeah. So my approach, and I was nominated to go first. And so I took, you know, because it was my idea, I took that job. So the very first chapter is all aerial scenes, mostly over snow-capped mountains and things like that. And my approach was sort of to go kind of literal with it and try to create sounds that were wide and beautiful, but also a little scary. And what you know, if you were flying over these mountains and you couldn't see them and you couldn't speak, what sound would best mirror what these mountains look like? And that was my goal, really, of my 3 or 4 minutes.
Wow.
And it was a lot of fun. And, you know, I think different composers went with different approaches into how to reflect their scenes. And it's really, really amazing to watch. A very dynamic set of music.
So, Betsy, how do people experience this film? I know Sam mentioned that you had sort of a premiere at the Anchorage Museum. Are we going to be getting some showings in Juneau? Are we going to be accessing this online? How do we get to watch this film next week?
Yeah, so it will go live nationally on September 27th, Friday next week. You'll be able to visit our website, sustainmusicandnature.org, and watch it there. We're also hoping to take it on tour to some museums across Alaska and the U.S. if possible. And we've been submitting it to different film festivals too. But if there's any listeners who, you know, have connections to screens, happy to get in touch for doing a showing in Juneau.
Well, I know that our studio sits right across from the Alaska State Museum, and I would think they would love to show the film, which I think would be really cool. And that's awesome. It's 11 minutes, you said. And it'll be on your website, and I'm assuming it will also be like on YouTube or something, where people Correct. Can access that, which is going to be kind of cool. And so I guess, you know, for you, Betsy, as the co-founder of Sustain Music and Nature, and I guess for this particular project, Refuge Alaska, what are the hopes for the audience to take away from this film?
I would hope that the audience feels that same, or at least an approximation of what it might feel like to actually be at these refuges, which are just honestly out of most people's budgets or capacities to go and visit. But if people don't know about them, then why should they vote to protect them or donate to like the Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuges? So by having that kind of emotional interaction through Refuge Alaska, we hope that they remember it when they're making decisions when it comes to the time to vote or to be philanthropic.
Fantastic. And any more projects coming up that might be set in Alaska? Juneau is right in the middle of a lovely rainforest.
That's true. Well, I know we do have a few artists who are wild about fly fishing. So stay tuned. Maybe we can get one of them out there.
I love that. Well, Gunthchish, for being here today and telling us a little bit about Refuge Alaska. Of course, you can find out more by going to sustainmusicandnature.org. It's going to be released next Friday, September 27th, and that's in honor of National Public Land Day, which is Saturday, the 28th. And you can Google National Public Land Day. There's a whole website for it at nps.gov, which you can find out more about that and how you might be able to provide some service or volunteer or do, you know, just get more information. And of course, Betsy, you have all kinds of other projects on your website as well that have mixed music and nature together that people can explore. So I really appreciate you coming on the program today and telling us about it. Gunathcheese, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely. Up next, the Juneau Ice Field is being highlighted by world-renowned polar explorers, and they're sharing their knowledge tomorrow at the Mendenhall Glacier. This is Juneau Afternoon on KTOO.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edie have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Biologists in a small plane are flying over a group of harbor porpoises in southeast Alaska. They're taking pictures of the porpoises using a high-resolution infrared camera, a new technique for surveying marine mammals. Biologists in Idaho have used infrared aerial photography to study mountain lions, animals that blend in with the rimrock and ponderosa pine landscape. The camouflaged cats look bright white in infrared photos and pop right out. Infrared photography has potential with marine mammals in cold Alaska waters, but this has not been tried on harbor porpoises. The animals may pop right out in contrast to the cold water, but even if the porpoise's body is not warm enough to show up with cold water flowing over it, the spout they exhale may be warm enough to pop out in the images. This technique has worked well with humpback whales. When they surfaced and exhaled, the spout shows up and their much bigger blowhole glows in the images. And seals, sea lions, walrus, and sea otters in the water also show up very nicely in aerial infrared photography. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. With a mission to explore and bring attention to the world's glaciers and ice fields, the Ice Legacy is a project coming next to Juneau's ice field. It will be the subject of a talk tomorrow night, Friday, September 20th at 7:30 p.m. at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, sponsored in part by the University of Alaska Southeast. You can follow the journey at icelegacy.org. And I'm joined now by Borga Osland.
Osland, yes.
Osland and Vincent Colliard. Yes. I'm going to cheese. Hi, Yadi. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both in the studio today. Wasa Iti, how's it going?
It's going well. And thank you for having us. Thank you for letting us play in your backyard here.
Oh, absolutely. Now, it's so great to have you here. And I didn't even realize in terms of doing my research how big our Juneau ice field actually is and that you all are on this journey to explore 20 of the largest ice fields in the world.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about this project?
Yeah, that's so Juneau is on that list, obviously. And it's actually the fourth time we are in Alaska to cross ice field. We crossed Stikine, we crossed Chugach, we crossed St. Elias, and now finally we're here back in Juneau. So we started the project in 2012 because we love snow and ice and we just want to show how important these cold places are for sustaining life on the planet.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if people recognize the journeys that you both have taken. You are renowned, world-renowned polar explorers. Like, I looked up some of these things. Borga, you're the first person to cross Antarctica solo and unsupported. What does unsupported mean?
Well, unsupported, it means simply that you take what you need for the whole journey with you in your sled. There is no dogs, no helicopter or, you know, any depots on the way. So you go from A to B, but basically with what you have in the sled.
Wow. Okay. Now, and just this year, Vincent, you set the record by reaching the South Pole solo and unassisted in 22 days and 6 hours. How did you do that?
Yeah, I'm still actually confused. probably because my wife was pregnant at the time and I thought it's now or never, so I should give it all.
And be fast.
And be fast, right? You had to be back for the congratulations on being a father.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, I mean, you have so many other records between you two and what you have done in all of this time, which is just unbelievable. And I'm just kind of fascinated by the journey. So where did the drive come from in you? We'll start with you, but like when you were a young boy, what happened to you that made you want to explore all of the polar regions?
Well, I think it's a little bit coincidence and destiny and things like that. But I always had an, urge for going into the unknown and adventure. And I always liked to spend time on in tents and on skis. So when I got the opportunity to cross Greenland in 1986, just like, you know, with three friends to do an adventure, I did it. And from then on, I thought, oh, wow, this is an amazing experience. And this is what I want to fill my life with. So I just started to do more and more.
Wow. Okay, what about you, Vincent? Where did this seed of inspiration come from to explore all these regions?
Yeah, I think for me, it's really a curiosity. I grew up in a place in a surfer town called Biarritz, in between the Atlantic Ocean and the Pyrenees Mountains. But there is no sea ice in where I come from. And I got really curious when I read stories of polar explorers and Vikings. Then I got curious and I went to travel in Svalbard when I was 17, 18. And then I think I caught the virus.
The bug, as they say, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I tried to force destiny and I met Birgir. For me, he was like a reference in terms of polar expeditions. And I thought, I want to learn from the best guys, as I hope to become one of them one day, maybe. And
and so here now you
it's
are.
Beautiful that we are together, partnering on this adventure together.
So when you were a younger person, was Borga already sort of a name that you were inspired by?
Yep. I heard Birgir was expert in his field. And for me, he's basically in the same line, you know, as Fridtjof Nansen and Roald Amundsen, two great famous polar explorers. And if there's one person today alive, I think it's Birgir that has their legacy.
Wow. That is that's nice praise right there from your partner.
Well, I'm humbled. Thank you, Vince, for saying that. And you've been a very good apprentice. You're not longer an apprentice, but very much a polar explorer in your own right. So, yeah.
Wow. And I know that he mentioned Roald Amundsen, which I know a lot of people in the United States recognize that name. Was that somebody that inspired you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the first trek across Greenland, I was inspired by Nansen's trek because he was the first to do that in 1888. And, you know, all these guys have been the big role models for me. Not just Amundsen and Nansen, but also Scott and Shackleton and, you know, those guys who did things back in the what we call the golden age of polar exploration, when there was no GPS and no airplanes and things like that. So they've been big, big inspirations for me. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so this project, let's get back to Ice Legacy. It's a wonderful name, by the way. There's a wonderful website that you can go to, icelegacy.org, to follow the journey that is taking place. Tell us about where this idea came from.
Well, the idea, I think it, originally it came from the seeing what is happening in the polar regions with my own eyes. I skied to the North Pole first time in 1990. And since then, you know, the ice has been reduced by 30%. And then we thought about, okay, what can we do? And we're not scientists. We want to maybe instead be that link and bridge between science and adventure. And I think those emotional parts, the storytelling is also important, not just the numbers that the scientist provides and which is needed, but also the visual image of those ice caps. And who knows, in by the end of this century, maybe 2/3 of the Juno ice field might be gone. And then you have some really beautiful images and some stories from a time when it was like it is now. So I think what we're doing it for the future, basically. But we also want to inspire people and make a sense that it's urgent that we do take climate change seriously, because these glaciers are basically dying.
Yeah. So Vincent, it's sort of like being able to take, I mean, obviously it fills your sense of adventure to be able to trek across these ice fields, but then also that journey, being able to inspire others to recognize what's going on with the glaciers and the climate and the ice fields. Yeah.
Yeah. And I really hope that we will manage to inspire people that will never get a chance to go in the polar regions, because we're really lucky. But probably most of the people on this planet won't go to the polar regions, won't see how, you know, how beautiful and how fragile these regions are. And so they're basically like, yeah, North Pole, let's say Arctic Ocean, North Pole, Antarctica, South Pole. They act like two big freezers and the rest of the 20 ice caps that we want to cross. And so, yeah, I think they really stabilize, you know, the temperatures. And so they're very crucial. And yeah, sometimes when it's too warm in summertime down south, we put on the air conditioner. And so when these glaciers are gone, maybe there's no more air conditioning system.
I know that people can, those who may not be able to experience, I know that our tourists can take a helicopter ride up to the ice field. One of our reporters went up there recently because they do dog sled training up there during the summer months, because they can't do it during the, you know, because in the summer it's harder to find access to that, which is really interesting. But you can, as a person who may not be able to do that or get up there, what we have seen, even just with the glacier, where you're going to be talking tomorrow, the receding glacier line, I mean, that's sort of an example of what we can see with our eyes, but it's happening. So tell me what's happening with the ice field as you've experienced it over your years, because you mentioned that, you know, you first started doing this in 1990, I think you said.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that 40 years, what changes have you seen in these regions?
Well, you don't necessarily see huge changes from one year to another, but within some decades, there is huge changes. And Vince and I, we did an expedition in Patagonia in 2013, and I was there first time in 2003, and the same place, and I didn't recognize myself. You know, the glacier had just totally changed since then in 10 years. So what is happening is that if it goes from minus, I'm talking in Celsius now, but from minus, let's say 20 to minus 18 Celsius, then nothing happens. But if it goes from minus 1 to plus 1, everything melts. And a lot of these glaciers are around that melt zone. So just a couple of degrees in difference make a huge, huge difference. And when they melt, they also lose altitude, which also means that you will not have as much snow because it's going to be lower. And so it's just a snowball effect. And on the long term, you know, it's also, we all know that the melting glacier will end up in the sea and contribute to sea level rise. And even during this century, a modest model will indicate about 1 meter sea level rise. And that's huge.
Wow.
That's going to change a lot of the world as we know it today.
That's unbelievable.
And also you spoke about you have this beautiful Mendel Glacier here, and so many people that go there just to see the glacier. And we're providing those images to a wider public to show what we're about to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is amazing. So where are you in the journey in terms of the 20 ice fields?
Well, depends.
Yeah, nearly, halfway, basically.
Halfway,
a little bit ahead for Berge, a little bit behind for me, as you did some glaciers
I crossed
before.
A couple of those before we teamed up, so it's like crossing Antarctica and things like that, and I'm not going to do that again, so you have to do that alone.
Yeah, light and fast, one day, hopefully.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, this is something I would never do, so I'm like so...
We'll do it for you.
Thank you, because I'm so inspired by it to see like what that would be like. Like, describe what it is to make one of these tracks.
To me, it's I have never been to space, but crossing an ice cap in certain places, I have the impression that I'm not in connection with planet anymore. I am exploring another world. Suddenly, it's only the rhythm of your own pace, of the quality of the snow, of the wind, the sun, some indications that you use for navigating, and it's you hear. I think you hear the sound of silence.
Yeah, you read my mind. I was just thinking of how silent it would be. Right. Yeah. I mean, or maybe all you're hearing is your feet in the snow as you're walking.
Yeah. And it's suddenly you hear as soon as there is one noise, you really hear it.
Mm.
And in society today, we're like, there's so much noise all the time. And an ice cap is free of noise. So you only hear the very basics.
Mm. Now, you mentioned we were talking about unassisted journeys. Are there rules around that? Are you able to take like a satellite phone, or do you take a safety? What is the safety measures that you have when you're taking one of these treks?
So, yeah, we have we carry both a satellite phone, and then we have a little device to communicate and send messages.
Okay.
For us, the essence of adventure is really to try to go unsupported, meaning that there is no help or support from the outside world, from civilization.
Wow.
Yeah, because 1,000 years ago, probably when the Vikings went across oceans, they didn't have any supports.
So when you're bedding down for the night, you're not scrolling Instagram and things like that?
No, and it's kind of sad that, you know, this Instagram is really as we speak now with technology today, we will be able to Instagram and scroll from the tents in the middle of Antarctica soon. It's coming.
Yeah,
and
with Starlink, right? Yeah, Starlink is making that possible. Now, do you take, I know we have a documentary crew in here filming us today. Do you take video when you're on a solo trip? Do you have some kind of camera that you're able to take some footage so you can capture that for later?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we do take quite a lot of photos and video. And this time we were very lucky. We had Sarah McNair and Eric Bomer. They will join us on the expedition and film and document as we go. So this time we will be four, actually.
Wow.
For the first time.
Oh, that is just amazing. Now, I know we've talked about sort of these journeys, like how hard it is. And I know that you had the 87-day Arctic expedition that you did. 87 days, it was described as grueling, and because that's a long time. That's almost 3 months.
Yeah.
Can you give us, Borga, one sort of, or maybe two of those worst moments that you've had in doing some of this exploration?
Well, you know, even the worst moments have a value, I think, because it's all about solving problems and making progress and reaching the goal in the end of the day. And that I feel, even if, you know, it's hard and bad things can happen. It what makes me alive and feel alive is those expeditions. And if it wasn't for the hardship and if it wasn't for the struggle, it would not be the same. So, but for the worst moment, I don't know, maybe it's when my partner, Mike Horn, went through the ice and into icy water in minus 30, which is, I don't know how much that is in Fahrenheit, but close to...
It's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was bad. That was, then I thought, this is it. This is the end of the expedition. But we managed to get out to it. And somehow, because we had trained for it,
right.
I put up my tent super fast and I got the stoves going. And gradually he warmed up and managed to get out to it without any injuries. So,
wow.
But yeah. And then it just became a good story.
Wow. Yeah, good stories they're scary sometimes too, though. Vincent, have you ever had a moment when you're alone on one of these solo expeditions and you've just said to yourself, like, what am I doing here? Has that ever happened or no?
Yeah, I think one time in with a couple of friends from France on a homemade sports catamaran, we tried to cross the Arctic Ocean. So actually from Alaska, from Prudhoe Bay, all the plan was to go from there to Svalbard, so on the others to Europe, basically through the North Pole. And yeah, so after 2 months of battling the sea ice and the salt, we had to turn back. And I never felt that isolated in my whole life. And it was the only time that I had my safety beacon on my chest pockets of my jacket all the time on the way back. Because I thought we're such a small boat in the open seas, in the Beaufort Sea. Mm. And I was pretty afraid that we would never come back.
That's amazing. Your journeys are amazing. And you're going to be sharing some information tomorrow night. What are we going to be learning tomorrow night at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center? What are you going to be talking about?
Well, you have to come and watch and see. We'll show a lot of nice photos and tell the story about what we're doing and share some experiences. Yeah, so please come tomorrow, 19:30, 7:30.
And when do you start the journey on the Juno ice field? When are you starting that?
We leave for Skagway on Saturday.
So wow. 2 days. So it's happening.
It's happening.
And will we be able to see some photos if we follow along at icelegacy.org?
Yeah, you will be able to. There's a map on our websites, and you will be able to follow the route, our position. And every second day, I think we'll leave a voicemail. So you will hear our voice from the tent and the updates from the field.
Yeah, I saw that on the website, the map that you have of all the different, and it sort of shows all the different places you're going to be going. And so people can sort of follow along with that. And I love that you're going to be providing some folks some updates so they can look out for that. So you can find out more at icelegacy.org. The talk is tomorrow night. It's Friday, September 20th at 7:30 p.m. at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Vincent and Borge will be there to share some photos and some wonderful stories about their adventures and actually talk a little bit more about what the purpose of this journey is and bringing the awareness of what's happening to our world and the importance of the glaciers and the ice fields to that particular part of our existence, really,
yes.
Which is fantastic. So Gunnath Cheese for being here. What a pleasure. What an honor to have you in the studio.
Thank you
so much. Really appreciate it. Okay. Okay, up next, we'll talk with Naomi Juno about their upcoming seminar, Family to Family. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kushtak'u Bilfasa. And the word this week is yeh.
Yeh.
That means raven. And here's a sentence.
Yeh. Nitrianakut.
Raven is walking along the beach. Let's hear it again.
Yes.
Raven. Gunnash Chish Dukhune Lance Twitchell, Goldbelt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kushtak O Ish Bill Fawcett was Slukach Adi and the child of a southern Toshone man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Sihua Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Akwan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
More treatments for depression? Spinally! This is Sandra Tsinglo with the lowdown on science. Your spine constantly communicates with your brain, sending messages like hungry or ow. But what about sad feelings? Major depressive disorder involves the body and the brain. Francisco Romo Nava and team from Ohio tackled treating the messenger. How? By using non-invasive spinal cord stimulation to send shockingly good vibes to battle depression. 20 adults were given either active or non-treatment. 24 times across 8 weeks, participants received 20 minutes of electrical current along the spine. The active group experienced a steady current, and the other group felt two small bursts. Participants said it felt like an itch. Researchers monitored blood pressure and depression symptom severity. The active group saw a decline in depression symptom severity, including sadness and pessimistic thoughts. Plus, reduced blood pressure was also observed. Spinal cord stimulation could supplement depression treatment plans or offer a medication-free option. So don't be taken aback by these electric advances.
The Lowdown on Science is produced by LDOS Media Lab in partnership with the University of California Irvine Science Communication and LAist, and made possible with the generous support of the Fuse Family Foundation.
Listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. NAMI, Friends and Family and Friends, is a seminar that informs people and informs and supports people who have loved ones with a mental health condition. This upcoming seminar is happening on Saturday, September 28th from 1 to 3 p.m. It will be at 877 Teal Street. And of course, you can find out more at namijuno.org/family-to-family. And Bonnie Chaney is in the studio with me now to share a little bit more about it. Hi, Bonnie. Good to see you for being here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's been a while, but I'm happy to be here. I'm promoting a couple of NAMI programs. And just an aside, you can call it NAMI or NAMI. Either way is fine.
Yeah, we've had that discussion on here before with some of the people who work there. And they're like, it's either way. But some people say NAMI, some people say NAMI. And it's like tomato, tomato, right? Data, data.
Well, I think it goes back to when NAMI was originally founded and it was just like a grassroots organization, a couple moms got together to kind of figure it out. So the NAMI mommies. So it's like kind of goes together better than NAMI mommies. So NAMI mommies.
It's easy to remember that way too, right? Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about NAMI Juno for those who may not have heard about it before.
Okay. So NAMI Juno is a local affiliate of the national NAMI organization, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And it's the largest grassroots organization for mental health. And it provides public awareness, education, advocacy, and support to primarily the families and friends of people who are living with a mental health condition. So, you know, I have a close family member who has a mental health condition. And that's how I got involved with NAMI 12 to 14 years ago. It's been a very long time now. And I'm still involved because I just think it's so important to educate people. Because I know when our family member was first diagnosed, we knew nothing. Mm. And I did take the family to family class back in, it might have been 2011. I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was a long time ago. And then I eventually joined the board and was on the board for 12 to 14 years. And I'm still heavily involved. I teach the family-to-family class sometimes. And there's the family and friends. Like, that's a two-hour seminar. And I also am a facilitator for support groups. So I'm still heavily involved.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great organization. And you have, so when you found out, or when you were looking for resources, had you already heard about NAMI, or was it something that you had to discover?
I had to discover it. And yeah, you know, it's been so long, I can't remember how I discovered it. So, like one of our goals throughout the years has been to raise the public awareness that we exist. And we, as the Juno affiliate, have a lot of resources for people. Mm-hmm. Not only like the classes that we offer, but we also have a peer support group for people that are living with mental health issues, and they can get help just talking to other people. You know, we don't provide counseling, but we do provide support. And we have our office out at on Teal Street, has a whole lending library. You can go in and borrow a book. And people are more than happy to talk to you about resources. There's a website called junomentalhealth.org that has a lot of resources. It tells you all the providers in Juno.
Yeah.
So that's another resource. But the folks at NAMI Juno are more than happy to help.
It's great because the peer support groups, the family to family class, the ongoing classes that you all have, and it just sort of allows you to not feel alone in the journey. And to find, you know, no need to reinvent the wheel, right? Somebody's right, probably going through the thing that you're going through or has gone through it.
Yes.
You're also, you know, as somebody who's teaching the class occasionally, you're somebody who's experienced it. So you're able to give that valuable advice to someone. Yes. And so NAMI has a great website, of course, NAMI Juno, N-A-M-I, Juno.org. And you can find out about all the different classes that are there and the ongoing ones. Let's talk about this family and friends seminar.
Okay.
A little bit, because that's a little different than the ongoing class. So what's happening in this particular seminar? And this is, again, next Saturday from 1 to 3 out at 2 Street.
So it's like a very high level overview of what you could learn in the family to family class.
Okay.
So we touch a little bit on mental health conditions. We touch a little bit on self-care for you as a family member, because it's very stressful. We touch a little bit on some therapies and medications. We talk about empathy. Mm. I was going to add with communication. It's so important when you're talking to somebody living with a mental health condition, because they don't necessarily interpret what you're saying the way you think you're saying it.
Mm.
So learning how to communicate with somebody with a mental health condition is very important, because you may not understand why they're thinking the way they're thinking or why they're behaving the way they're behaving, but that is their reality. And you have to come to them and talk to them that is their reality. It may not be your reality. And I think that communication piece and the empathy that they are going through something that you can't really understand, but to accept that is their reality. And that's huge.
I think that's a lesson of obviously specifically for this instance, of course, but it also seems like that could be a lesson for general life too, because everybody hears things a little bit differently,
right,
and learning how to communicate and the ways that people are able to receive information from you, as opposed to, you know, it's easy to default to, why don't you understand me?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, why don't you get what I'm trying to say? Well, maybe because they are needing it in a different pattern or a different way of being said or a different structure or something like that. So being able to learn that in general, but also specifically if you're someone who is a family or friend of somebody dealing with mental health issue.
And something, the way you just phrased something, why don't you? You know, that's a you statement.
Yeah.
You know, like you should do this, as opposed to an I statement where you say, I feel that I would like to understand you better or communicate with you better. So you're putting it on you.
Yeah.
You know, on yourself, the I person.
Yeah.
Because someone can get very defensive if you keep saying you.
Yeah.
So communication is a huge piece of it. So you'll touch on that in the family and friends. So that's only a 2-hour class.
Yeah.
So if you take the family to family class, that's like a 20-hour class where we discuss things in much more detail, like the whole, the different kinds of mental health issues that you can have. You know, there's anxiety, depression. Those are the ones that people hear a lot about. Bipolar, So we discuss those, we discuss medications, we discuss other therapies. We go more into communication. We talk more about self-care. So this is just like this family and friends class is just a tiny introduction to what you can learn in the family to family class. And it's extraordinarily valuable. And we practice those things. We practice communication. We have a whole exercise on empathy. And so I think that if you have a family member that's dealing with a mental health issue right now and you're struggling yourself, that both of these are valuable.
I love that. Well, Bonnie, thank you so much for coming in. It's the NAMI Family and Friends Seminar. It's next Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. It gives you an overview of all the programs. And you can also find out more about the full-length family-to-family class at namijuno.org. Thank you so much, Bonnie. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And that's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Have a terrific Thursday. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. You can find out more at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh, and have a warm and wonderful Juno evening.